Welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we have a very important guest, Dr. Leonard Lichtenfeld, who is the Deputy Chief Medical Officer for the American Cancer Society. And with me, of course, is Robin Martinez, my co-host. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Joyce. How's everything with you?
Doing very well, thanks. And today we should definitely mention is the very first World Kidney Cancer Day. And I've worn my green lipstick today, Robin. How about you?
I never wear lipstick, Joyce, but I will wear my World Kidney Cancer Day t-shirt.
Great. So, and anybody who catches us on Twitter will see a picture of me and Snowy wearing our green lipstick.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yes. So at this point, we'd like to introduce Dr. Lichtenfeld. He is also the director of the Society's Cancer Control Science Department. This group of internationally recognized experts focuses on the prevention and early detection of cancer, as well as emerging science and trends in cancer, and is responsible for producing the guidelines for prevention and early detection of cancer, including nutrition and physical activity. And today we're going to be talking about an article from their journal, Cancer. So welcome, Dr. Lichtenfeld.
Hello, glad to be here.
Great, thank you. So in a recent issue of your journal, Cancer, there's another article in a series of articles in recent years about the issue of, quote, financial toxicity, unquote, in cancer care. Can you please help us understand what is meant by the phrase financial toxicity?
Well, the phrase financial toxicity, as used by most oncologists today, actually refers to something a little different than what's in the article. It generally refers to the high cost of the cancer of many of the drugs that are currently used to treat cancer. So what we've seen over the past number of years is the increasing use of what we call biologics or targeted therapies for cancer, which are more specific than the older drugs that we used to primarily use. And those newer drugs are more expensive, and quite honestly, some of the drugs that have been around for a decade or more have also been increasing in cost. So when we discuss the topic of financial toxicity, it generally refers to the high cost of the drugs that are currently used and are likely most effective to be used in the treatment of cancer. This particular article talks about, in a more general sense, what patients do, those who have been recently diagnosed with cancer and those who have been diagnosed in the recent past with cancer, and refers to the fact that they are approaching their physicians in fairly significant numbers asking for modifications of their treatment program, raising the of their even for their general medications for high blood pressure and diabetes, cholesterol, what have you, and raising the concern that perhaps they're also not taking their routine medications and perhaps not taking their cancer medications as under the best conditions. Let's put it that way. They may be skipping doses. They may be taking it every other day instead of every day, whatever the case may be. So looked at in a large picture, we're really talking about the financial impact of cancer on the routine care of patients with that disease.
So I noticed in the article there's a distinction drawn between the elderly and the, quote, non-elderly or people under 65. Why this distinction?
Well, I suspect it's common knowledge that there's a line drawn at age 65 for many patients because many folks are eligible for Medicare. They don't have employer-based insurance or they don't have employer-based insurance that covers them after they retire, so they then go on the Medicare program. And as part of the Medicare program, people are able to get their medications through what is called Part D. And the although there are concerns about the costs of the Part D program, including deductibles and copays, what have you, the reality is it can be a more generous program than having employer-based or privately sourced insurance, where the drug benefit may not be as good as it is under the Medicare program. So as a result, when you look at the, when in this particular article research, when they looked at these survey results, they saw that patients in the Medicare program had a substantially lower frequency of asking doctors to change their treatment regimen than did patients who were privately insured or perhaps didn't have insurance, but people who were under the age of 65.
Did the study look at financial aid that's available to help support the cost of copays? And did it look at which patients were taking advantage of it or which patients had been denied financial aid?
That was not the focus of this report. This was a survey study. It's a survey that's done regularly by the federal government through the Centers for Disease Control, looking at a variety of issues related to patients and the care they receive in a number of different arenas. And they happened to ask this question at the time they did the survey. It did not address financial aid programs that are available from various nonprofit organizations or from the pharmaceutical companies themselves.
What's your experience with the Cancer Society? Do people regularly seek those kinds of assistance or not?
Well, we have a call center at 1-800-227-2345 that's available 24 hours a day. And yes, we do get calls from people who have difficulty paying for their medications, for their cancer medications. And we do work with other organizations that help guide patients to available resources, including, as I mentioned, the pharmaceutical companies. But there are also a number of other cancer nonprofit organizations that do assist patients in that regard.
Go ahead, Robin.
Okay. So the study asked people if they had modified their adherence to their prescribed medication in any way. And it looked like it was encouraging that about a quarter of the respondents had talked with their doctor about possibly switching to a less expensive medication. How often do you think that's possible?
Well, we have to, again, understand that could happen for a lot of reasons. So, for example, the patients who have other medical conditions, such as I mentioned, diabetes, high blood pressure, cholesterol, can take a variety of different medications. And sometimes the reason may be as straightforward as the fact that what we call the formulary of the insurance plan may change. So that can happen from even year to year if you stay with the same insurance plan. And it certainly is likely to happen if you change from one plan to another. So you may be on a particular drug that is working well for you, and you may tolerate that medication, and you change to a different insurance plan the following year, and you find out that that medication is not a preferred drug on that new plan's formulary. It may be much more expensive, and you can ask your doctor, your healthcare professional, to change to something that may be on the formulary and consequently less expensive. That's one reason. However, I think it's important to point out that in the non-elderly population, in this particular survey, in this particular analysis of that survey, that among the non-elderly population, more patients with cancer made those requests than patients who did not have cancer. And, of course, that also varied by the number of other conditions that a person had. So, we're all becoming more sensitive to medication costs because of these preferred drugs, non-preferred drugs, what's on the formulary, what's not on the formulary. So it's becoming a more common conversation as people understand better how these various insurance plans work and how these formularies work. By the same token, it also applies to the more expensive cancer drugs. Sometimes a drug may be very expensive and your doctor may say, this is what I think is the best drug for you, but in fact there may be less expensive options that could produce the same or sometimes even better results at substantially lower cost. So there are a lot of factors that get into this, we have to think about as we talk in regard to this particular issue.
Would you say that the growing prevalence of oral cancer drugs is changing this landscape somewhat?
Well, there are more drugs that are available orally, and for some of us, we think that's a good thing. That can certainly change the way you have to see your cancer care team when we talk specifically about cancer. Because if you take an oral drug, you don't have to come in quite as frequently as you do when you have to get intravenous drugs. It's a lot more convenient for a lot of patients, particularly folks who live at a great distance away from where they get their cancer care. And this is a big country, and a lot of people live in rural areas, and they don't have immediate access to an oncologist office. Having said that, one of the problems that comes up with oral medications is that people don't necessarily take them the way they should. There have been a number of studies that have been done over many years that confirm the fact that even though it's treatment for cancer, not everybody takes the medications as they should. But having said that, it's easier to take oral medications, and sometimes the side effects are less, although I don't want to minimize that. Sometimes the side effects can be pretty severe.
Right. What about differing coverage for drugs that are given intravenously versus drugs that are given orally?
That's an important point. And, in fact, a number of states have passed legislation requiring the insurance plans to treat those drugs the same way. It's, again, a complicated issue for most people to understand, but let me try to explain it. When you get a drug in a doctor's office, and let's use Medicare as an example, it's considered part of what is termed a medical benefit. That means it's a drug that is handled between the doctor and the insurance company for the most part, or sometimes there may be a specialty pharmacy that sends you the medication in the mail or whatever. But having said that, it's a medical benefit. It's handled under the medical policy, the medical deductibles, the medical copays, whatever it may be, and generally is more advantageous for the patient. When you go to the pharmacy and you pick up an oral medication, it's under the pharmacy benefit, and that's a different different benefit structure, different company that pays the bill to the pharmacy for that medication, and as a result can be substantially more expensive. Copays can be a lot more when the drug is obtained from a pharmacy and was given orally. So this difference can be substantial. And it means a lot of out-of-pocket costs for patients, and a lot of folks don't have the funds or the wherewithal to pay those out-of-pocket costs. And as I mentioned, a number of states have passed legislation to try to even the playing field, that the same rules apply in both settings. However, that's not true in every state. But it's a good point because it can make a big difference in what your out-of-pocket costs are going to be for that medicine.
I was finding it helpful that almost 25% of the people that were surveyed were engaging with their doctor about the cost of medication. I think it's a good thing that they're at least edging into a conversation with their doctor. But my own experience is that when you ask your doctor about costs, the doctor frequently doesn't know what the cost is of one medicine versus another. What's your own experience with that?
Well, I have to say I'm not sure that having 24% of the patients asking that question is necessarily good. It could be good, and we should have those conversations. But the implication in this study is that more cancer patients than non-cancer patients are asking that question because they're having more difficulty paying for their medicine. So because of all the costs and problems associated with cancer care and cancer treatment, that means you have to watch your dollars elsewhere. And in reality, there apparently are more cancer patients who have that conversation than the non-cancer patients. So although it's good to have those discussions, in this particular study, it's considered to be a sign of difficulty that patients are having. On the cancer side of the equation, that is when we talk about the high costs of these medicines and what's involved, there's an increasing emphasis. Increasingly, doctors and their office staff are having the conversations about the high cost of medicine and the affordability of the medicines, recognizing this, as we talked about earlier in this discussion, recognizing that we're talking about financial toxicity and these costs are not inconsequential. And again, as I mentioned a moment ago, most folks don't have the money to in the bank, so to speak, to cover some of those costs. So understanding the costs, understanding responsibilities, understanding what options might be available is important, and that is a good thing. There are programs that are going on around the country through the Medicare program and what's called the oncology care model, and where some practices around the country have signed up for that program with Medicare, and that program is encouraging doctors' office staff and the doctors and the patients to have the conversations that you need to have. Unfortunately, for some patients, there just are no options, and they can't afford the medicines, and those are the ones where all of us worry the most about. That's a situation none of us like to see happen, but unfortunately, it does happen, and there's no easy solution, no easy answer for those folks.
To give our non-cancer listeners an idea of the costs involved, we recently had a comment from a patient talking about high-priced drugs and saying, my prescription costs $14,000 a year, and thought that was a high amount until a cancer patient responded, my drug costs that much every month.
It's a month, right. Yes. I mean, that's what we're talking about generally when we talk about financial toxicity. Some of these medicines do cost $14,000 or even $15,000 a month, and sometimes there's some recommended treatments for melanoma, for example, where you take two of those medicines together, so now you're into the $200,000 range. That is way more than any of us, except the most wealthy among us, can afford. And what we've seen through various studies is there's some drugs that have been around, as I mentioned, for one drug in particular, for close to 15 years. And that drug has increased stepwise, if not, I don't know if it's every year, but certainly has increased stepwise over time, where it's now much more expensive than it was when it was first introduced 15 years ago. So these are issues that are getting attention among health professionals. They're certainly getting attention among patients, and they are a topic of discussion at both state and national levels. The question is, what do you do about that? We live in a country that, in Europe, for example, the government dictates whether a drug will be available, and the government dictates, for the most part, not every country, but many countries, dictates what the government's willing to pay. And if it's more than what the government's willing to pay, then the people don't have access. Basically, let's say the word I would use is society and government makes a difference, and the people allow the government to take that role. In the United States, that's not the case. For some government plans, there is some degree of negotiation, but not for most of them, and certainly not for Medicare. As a result, the drug prices are very, very expensive. On the other hand, these drugs do some pretty spectacular things for some patients. Not enough patients, but for some patients, they can have very spectacular results. And yet, we're developing drugs that might be useful for 4,000 people in this country a year or less. And those are very small markets, and not everybody takes the drug for an entire year. So you have to always balance, or the key issue here that's always talked about is balancing the cost of the drug to make it worthwhile for the pharmaceutical companies and others to invest in the research to develop those drugs. There are arguments to be made on both sides of that question, how much transparency there is to these costs. If you follow the press, in some states they're passing laws requiring drug companies to be more transparent about their costs of development and risk. And another factor that has to be considered is that for every drug that succeeds, there are many, many failures. And so not every drug gets to market, which is another factor. So it's we're entering a new era in this discussion. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. But the reality is we are getting to a point where we are going to create drugs that are be used in only a very small number of people. And some of those drugs will only be used a single time. This new therapy, it's called CAR-T, which is taking lymphocytes from the blood and changing them, engineering them in a way to putting them back in the body to attack cancer. That's a one-shot therapy. And it's not a simple therapy or an easy therapy. It's not something you're going to go to your local oncologist to get. It's going to be given to centers that are experienced. But you can imagine it's only one shot. And if it works, it works so far dramatically well for some patients. And how much is it going to cost, and how are we going to continue investing in the research remains to be seen. But the fact is, the costs are going to probably be, the estimates are higher than what we have seen so far for some of the other drugs that have come on the market more recently.
Right. The discouraging thing for me, though, was to see how many people are skipping doses or delaying or failing to fill a prescription or in other ways keeping their own costs down by simply not doing what the doctor had prescribed. And so I think that lack of communication between the patient and the doctor is very troubling.
Well, there's a long history of that well before we got into the question about the cost of cancer drugs.
Right.
I've been a doctor a long time, and not only have I been an oncologist, I've also been a primary care physician. And unfortunately, when you go look at the data, a lot of people don't take the drugs they're supposed to take, not necessarily because of cost, but because they just don't do it. And the reality is, in this country, we could have a marked improvement in treating diseases like high blood pressure and diabetes and heart disease, preventing those diseases, if we used the drugs we know work the right way. I've lived in a small town in South Georgia, and one of the biggest buildings in town was the Artificial Kidney Center. And you can't go past the building like that on a regular basis and not wonder that if people would take their drugs the way they're supposed to, whether how many people would need that center. And it's been true before and it's true now, and it's unfortunate that we haven't yet found a way to help patients take their medications the way they should for the maximum benefit. I tell the story about my dad, who passed away in the 1950s because he didn't have any medicines for blood pressure, didn't have any medicines for other conditions, and today those medicines cost pennies. And you can only imagine if we were able to get everyone to take the medicines they're supposed to take and make the lifestyle changes they need to make, we could markedly improve the health of this country and the world, for that matter.
Right. And so what I'd like to say to patients, because our program is mostly for patients, and that is, if for whatever reason you feel you don't want to fill the prescription or you don't want to take the dosage that your doctor has prescribed, talk to your doctor. Don't just make the unilateral choice of not filling the prescription or skipping doses. You need to have a conversation with your doctor about how to adjust that smartly in some way. And I think that conversation is very important, which is why I was finding it hopeful that they're at least having that conversation with the doctor about cost.
Well, as I mentioned, this particular study is focused on the fact that more patients who have cancer are need to have that conversation as opposed doing it for the reasons that you're talking about. But yes, having a regular health professional, whether it's a doctor, maybe a nurse practitioner, maybe a physician's assistant, but having someone you can identify as providing your care, that you know who to call when there's a problem, that you see regularly, and then following the instructions, and then also having conversations with, let's say, the medicine, you don't feel right on the medicine, or you want to try a different medicine, maybe some side effect, whatever. Having a health professional who's responsible for your care that you can identify has actually been shown in research studies to be one of the most important indicators of staying in good health. or achieving good health. That is controlling your blood pressure, controlling cholesterol, controlling if you have diabetes. And if you get in a situation where you don't have such a person that you can call or know who they are or you can have a discussion with, then the chances are you're not going to be as successful in your journey, no matter what the condition is.
And a large part of that is because of diligence in taking your prescription as prescribed. If you have somebody that you can talk to about problems that you're having with that, whether it's side effects or cost or the pharmacy denied the refill because you were too early or too late in ordering it, various reasons, if you have somebody, a medical professional that you can talk to about that, the diligence in taking your prescription regularly goes way up.
There's no question about that. And you know, our medical care system has gotten pretty complicated. I will share with you that as a health professional and somebody who's been involved in healthcare for not only as a doctor, also as a patient, and also somebody who's been involved in the policy issues for a long time, it's gotten really complicated. So even trying to find out where you go to get your medicines and then getting in touch with those folks, making sure the prescription gets to them, sometimes is a lot more difficult than it should be. It's one thing we have systems where we can get the prescription from your doctor down to the corner pharmacy, but now there's a lot of effort being made to centralize those prescriptions, and sometimes, as it has happened to me recently, the prescription couldn't get to the central location somewhere in the Midwest, and then by the time it got to me in the mail, it took a long time. The bottom line is you've got to be your own advocate. You've got to stay on top of things. You've got to ask questions. You've got to pick up the phone and call people. And you know, if you have on chronic medications, it's not a good idea to run out. And sometimes if you have blood pressure, even a couple of days or whatever off your medicine, your blood pressure can go up, and that puts you at risk of other complications. So, but our healthcare system isn't helping matters a whole lot. It's gotten pretty complicated knowing which doctors do. And you're very much aware of that as your listeners, knowing which doctors are on your plan, which doctors you can see, are they available, do they live nearby you, or if you live in certain parts of the country, is there even a doctor that you need to see that's available for you to see? So that's one of the major issues that people are facing, and I suspect it's going to get more difficult before it gets any better.
Right, and part of the toxicity of this whole situation is the upsetness that it creates in the household. Are we going to lose the house? Do we need to sell the car? Can we send that kid to college? I mean, all of this anxiety is not helping them recover from cancer.
The American Cancer Society became involved in not so much lobbying for the Affordable Care Act, but at least setting the stage, doing the research that showed we needed to do something many years ago. And it was very, very clear that the number of people, we had people who were calling us who, in fact, did go bankrupt. You know, if somebody gets cancer, you don't continue your job on a daily basis. Now, sometimes you do, but frequently you don't. Nobody wants to get cancer. Nobody expects to get cancer. And when that happens, when that moment comes, it can be incredibly disruptive, especially if you have some types of cancer that really demand that you be treated immediately because of something associated with the cancer. Acute leukemia comes to mind. Well, you know, most of us haven't prepared for that. And the sad reality is that our work life gets disrupted, our family life gets disrupted, we may not be able to keep our jobs, and of course many of us have insurance through our jobs, and that raises all sorts of other questions. And the other issue that's now becoming even more of a helping to contribute to the problem is that a lot of our kids don't live where we live. So if you get older and you get cancer, now all of a sudden you have a family, you don't have anybody to really turn to. It becomes even more difficult. So all those issues are part of that larger picture that we need to pay attention to. There, again, no simple answers. Some communities have come together to provide help. The American Cancer Society does provide, in many communities around the country, rides to get people to cancer treatment. But you know, I think most of us have gone through this experience, or we know people who have, where the diagnosis of cancer has been so disruptive. And as we talk, for example, about the modifications that are being proposed in the Affordable Care Act, you know, we have to be aware that the people be able to continue their coverage, but also be aware that for that first 30 days, 30, 60 days, you may be living in a fog or you may be fighting for your life. And you may lose your work-related insurance. You have to transition into a insurance policy on the exchange if one's available. Those are topics that are very much a part of where we are today. And again, there are no easy answers, but we at least at the American Cancer Society feel strongly we want to do what we can to help preserve, you know, the best opportunity for everyone to get the cancer care they need and not go back to where we were many years ago when people went bankrupt, couldn't get care, and unfortunately had to face dire consequences as a result.
Well, thank you very much for advocating for that. And I want to remind everybody that you can call 1-800-4-CANCER and reach the American Cancer Society hotline. Is there any other final words you'd like to share? Sure.
If I may, the phone number is 1-800-227-2345. That's the number for the American Cancer Society. 1-800-227-2345.
2345, and I'll be sure to add that to the page online. Any other final comments that you would like to make before we wind up?
I think this is obviously a very important topic, and your point that you made earlier is also important. If you have a problem, talk to your health professional. Don't let it fester. Don't let it hide. Let them know that there's difficulty, and reach out to, in particular if you're a patient with cancer, reach out to organizations like the American Cancer Society. Let us help you navigate the waters, so to speak. You're not there alone. You shouldn't be there alone. But you have to speak up. You have to speak up to your healthcare team. You have to speak up to organizations. You have to speak up to your family. Be your advocate, and that gives you the best opportunity for a successful journey, particularly when it comes to treatment for cancer.
Thank you very much, Robin. Final words.
No, I think, well, I will tell you that the 4-CANCER number, 800-4-CANCER, is NCI's number, the National Cancer Institute.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I forgot about that. Thanks. So, also, don't forget about organizations that support your particular kind of cancer. And, you know, like kidney cancer, for example, or Smart Patients is also a wonderful resource. So reach out and talk to one of us. We'll be glad to help you. So thanks, everybody, and I hope that you have a great week ahead of you. We'll see you again next time. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you.